Part 4. Slaves to the Machine. How did we get hacked? Chapter 11. Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of Happiness? No man is an island, wrote British poet John Donne, 1572-1631. Each of us influences everyone else around us, whether in our family or our community. Wise words. The quote continues, quote, any man's death diminishes me because I am involved in mankind, and therefore never send to know for whom the bell tolls. It tolls for thee, unquote. If Donne is right, and he is, our personal happiness is tied up in the general level of contentment or distress within the rest of the population. If I'm unhappy, is everyone around me unhappy? And if they're unhappy, was I the cause, or is there an outside force detrimental to each and every one of us? Chapters 3 through 10 delineated the reward and contentment pathways as 1. Distinct, 2. Overlapping, 3. Regulatable, and, most importantly, 4. Interactive. We're told that things will make us happy, but they don't. We're told we should be ecstatic, but we're not. Because what we're told is based on a faulty premise, that pleasure and happiness are one and the same. A premise ingrained in the American psyche and indeed throughout Western civilization. Industry and government call it economic progress, but it is they who have subverted the meanings of these two emotions, reward versus contentment, pleasure versus happiness, for their own purposes. And we bought the subversion, both figuratively and literally. It's the bedrock on which our economy is built. We spend money on hedonic pleasures, trying to make ourselves happy, and in the process we drive dopamine, reduce dopamine receptors, increase cortisol, and reduce serotonin to ever further distance ourselves from our goal. The cognitive dissonance between our expectations and our reality is deafening. But what happens when this cognitive dissonance is societal, on a grand scale? What happens when you go from, it's all about me, to, it's all about we? The science that belies the interaction between reward and contentment fuels both individual and societal unhappiness. In chapters 11 through 15, I will demonstrate, in turn, how the confusion between these two terms in the name of progress has inflicted personal, economic, historical, cultural, and health and healthcare detriments to the individual and to society in general. Moreover, this confusion continues to be stoked by industry and government in order to preserve and sustain persistent economic growth at the expense of the populace. Some would argue that a strong stock market and an increasing GDP must mean we're on the right track. Yet, even before the 2016 election, 3/4 of the country thought we were on the wrong track. This is flagrant cognitive dissonance. Why? Well, we can't possibly fix the problem if we don't understand it. The Abdication of the Declaration. Thus far, we've equated individual happiness with eudaimonia, or contentment. What does societal happiness look like? Is collective unhappiness also driven by dopamine, cortisol, and serotonin? How do you define it? How would you measure it? How do you know if you've run off the rails? And if you have, how would you fix it? To demonstrate this cognitive dissonance on a societal level, let's take a familiar example. America. We have the best system of government ever devised, although lately it has been put to the test. We have more natural resources than any other country. We have personal liberties that are unparalleled. We have a constitution that, in the past, has equalized personal versus governmental authority and has allowed the individual to flourish. And we have a series of checks and balances that, while often acutely fallible, over time have tended to right themselves. Winston Churchill said, You can always count on America to do the right thing after they've tried everything else. Witness the zigzag successes of the civil rights struggle, changes in gender and now transgender equality, and same-sex marriage. Although most of the world still envies us, we've recently taken a hit due to the U.S. government's foray into isolationism and protectionism. One reason America remains a prime target for terrorism is that the internet and social media now demonstrate to the have-nots what it looks like to be the haves. And they've subscribed to the premise, if you can't join them, beat them. Yet for all of its benefits, fairness, and provisions for economic opportunity, America is very unhappy. Our Declaration of Independence assures us of the rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Well, life is going in the wrong direction, as witnessed by an increase in the American death rate and a decline in the mean American lifespan. Compared to other developed countries, American life expectancy is not all that terrific, only 26th out of the 37 in the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD, the most wealthy countries. But now, U.S. federal data drawn from all deaths recorded in the country show that life expectancy for women fell from 81.3 in 2014 to 81.2 in 2015. For men, life expectancy fell from 76.5 to 76.3 years. And this is true across demographics. Age-adjusted death rates increased in 2015 from 2014 for non-Hispanic black males, 0.9%, non-Hispanic white males, 1.0%, and non-Hispanic white females, 1.6%. This is a measure that economists use to quantify societal health, and it is the first time in recorded history where U.S. lifespan has declined. While it doesn't seem like much, statisticians argue that this is a watershed moment in our country's history. In addition, between 2014 and 2015, America saw an increase in infant mortality. Despite our prowess in advanced healthcare technology, America ranks 34th in perinatal mortality among all countries. Black babies are twice as likely to die at birth than white babies. These indices are used by policymakers to gauge the vibrancy, health, and stability of individual countries. Their deterioration foreshadows a very uncertain future for America. Now, liberty is a mixed bag. We have many social freedoms, yet we are stuck in metaphorical jails of our own construction, whether they be private gated communities or urban ghettos. Even when we try to pry ourselves out of them, we haven't really escaped. Harvard economist Raj Chetty has shown that children born in poor neighborhoods have only a 1 in 10 chance of being able to improve their financial situation and social standing. The neighborhood you grew up in predicts your chance for upward mobility. For example, each additional year that a child spends growing up in suburban Chicago, Illinois, raises the household income in adulthood by 0.76%. That's worth a 15% annual salary bonus at adulthood compared to the national average. Conversely, each additional year spent growing up in inner city Baltimore lowers the annual earnings by 0.86%. So for a Baltimore native, that's worth a 17% annual reduction in salary by adulthood. In the immortal words of Eagles frontman Don Henley and the late Glenn Frey, you can check out anytime you like, but you can never leave. And happiness? The hard data of the increase in death rate and decline in lifespan serve as markers of our societal unhappiness. With the obesity and metabolic syndrome epidemics in full force and continuing to worsen, common sense would dictate that these excess deaths would be occurring at the upper end of the age pyramid, and that type 2 diabetes and all of its complications would be knocking off the elderly. But that is not what is seen. Rather, these alarming mortality statistics are being driven by the deaths of white Americans. While America has been preoccupied with the continuing specter of the murders of young black men and police officers, deaths from drug overdose have reached an all-time high. In 2015, there were more deaths from opioid overdose than there were from shootings. Nobel Prize winner Angus Deaton and economist wife Anne Case have tracked this demographic group relative to other countries and relative to other racial groups. This increase in deaths was largely ascribed to 1. Acute self-inflicted poisonings, which suggests suicide. 2. Accidental overdoses of prescription and street opiates in people who had already become addicted. And 3. Cirrhosis of the liver due to chronic alcohol abuse. And all of these preventable deaths are being tallied in white America, the demographic with the highest income of any group on the planet, although the data argue that within these white American statistics, the highest mortality rates are actually in those with only a high school education. Deaton and Case point to a cumulative disadvantage over life, which is unrelated to income but exacts itself through the labor market, in marriage and child outcomes, and in health decrements. Since the advent of Prozac in 1987, suicides and suicide attempts have declined slightly in the U.S. as a whole. Yet, in the otherwise well-to-do white middle-class demographic, the opposite is apparent, with a 2.3% increase in the suicide rate in 2015. If we're pursuing happiness, we sure aren't catching up to it. Thomas Jefferson versus George Mason versus the pursuit of property. How did we get to this place in time? And how and when did happiness become subverted by pleasure? A brief but deep dive into American history will help, because you can't understand the message unless and until you understand the messengers. Our politicians routinely cite the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, interpreting the words and the intentions of our founding fathers. But who were these men, and why did they craft these specific cornerstones of our democracy? That last clause of the Declaration, the pursuit of happiness, has a very checkered history. It was mentioned twice in print in 1776, and then it disappeared, never to be written again. In its place, the U.S. Constitution replaced the word happiness with property. The acquisition of the tangible quickly superseded the quest for inner contentment. What happened to happiness? How did it get stricken from the record? The pursuit of happiness is an inconsequential anachronism today, conceived of our best intent, yet reduced to our worst ignominy. The famed economist and pundit Robert J. Samuelson in 2012 wrote, quote, "The happiness movement is at best utopian, at worst it's silly and oppressive," unquote. He argued that the pursuit of happiness may be a right guaranteed by the Declaration, but its achievement is not an entitlement. Maybe he's right, because we're only guaranteed its pursuit. Instead, the Due Process Clause of the Fifth Amendment of the Constitution assures us of the government's inability to deprive us of our right to life, liberty, and property. Property? Is property the booby prize for happiness? Or is property, as stated in the Fifth Amendment, just the guarantee of an individual's right to acquire those necessities in life that can ensure happiness? In other words, is property a means to an end, or an end in itself? Is property necessary to one's happiness? Can one be happy without property? Or does one need it to be happy at all? Is happiness rooted in material possessions? Thomas Jefferson, the primary author of the Declaration of Independence, was a master of eloquence and brevity. He charged our 13 separate colonies to organize for a common cause and a set of common goals. He imbued our nascent country, on the verge of a revolution never accomplished in world history, to soaring aspirations, to be better than we were. Happiness was right up there with life and liberty. Not a word about pleasure. Hey, when you're staging a rebellion, the central tenet can't be about dopamine. Nothing so sordid as a pint of rum, the substance of abuse at the time, which apparently was the coin of the realm back in 1776. Yet it turns out that Jefferson lifted the line about happiness from his contemporary George Mason, who composed the Virginia Declaration of Rights, which was adopted by the Virginia legislature just 3 weeks before the fateful vote that established the Union. Mason was a student of history, but not of creative writing or oratory. He drew on a long tradition of statements of rights and liberty, including the Magna Carta of 1215, the Habeas Corpus Act of 1679, and British statesman John Locke's Second Treatise on Civil Government in 1690. Mason's actual verbiage in the Virginia document reads, quote, "Life and liberty, with the means of acquiring and possessing property, and pursuing and obtaining happiness and safety." Unquote. None of Mason's primary sources mentioned happiness. He threw that in on his own. And Mason didn't just want to be able to pursue it, but to actually obtain it, at least for some people. A unique mindset for those times, to be sure. Jefferson liked the idea of including happiness, borrowed Mason's line, and reworked it for his declaration, but then he deleted the property clause. Now, why would he do that? Didn't Jefferson believe in property? Or did he consider pleasure and happiness to be the same thing? More has been written about the moral vicissitudes of the enigmatic Jefferson than virtually any of our founding fathers, although Alexander Hamilton got the musical. Jefferson had more layers than a Shakespearean tragedy merged with a John Grisham novel. He was a patrician with a big bankroll, spent years living in luxury in France, and most importantly, was a slave owner. And back in 1776, slaves were property. You'd think he, of all people, would have defended the right to accumulate and maintain property. But Jefferson deep-sixed the concept of property in the Declaration. Was deleting the property clause from Mason's original text Jefferson's method of absolving himself from his own shame and moral guilt that he felt as a slave owner, making peace with his slave ownership? Was he instead perhaps advancing the cause of abolition? Or did it simply imply that you couldn't very well pursue happiness unless you had property, including slaves? Many books have been written on this subject, perhaps the most revealing by historian Henry Winsek. It's not clear whether Jefferson truly abdicated happiness for property, because he couldn't rescue the clause when the Constitution was drafted, since he was serving as ambassador to France. Mason was also a very curious character in the history of our Union. He was the first to mention happiness as a goal of life and of government. Yet, happiness eluded him most of his life. His father drowned when he was 10, and his mother brought him up alone. He was an extremely bright student, and although he wasn't formally educated at the bastions of learning of the day, he had resounding success in business dealings throughout his life, and he became an extremely rich man, spending quite a bit of energy amassing property. His estate, Gunston Hall, was right next door and second in size to Mount Vernon, and he and George Washington had several business dealings before and throughout the Revolutionary War. He was married with 10 children. However, his first wife, Anne, passed away giving birth to twins in 1773. In between, he was a Virginia statesman when he wrote his Virginia Declaration of Rights, in which happiness was a primary goal. No doubt his loneliness and possible depression during this interval weighed heavily on his mind, until Mason married his second wife, Sarah Brent, in 1780. At this point, a perusal of Mason's medical file is in order. Mason was quite affluent. But apparently, his money could not buy him happiness. In fact, he was in pain for most of the second half of his life. Check out the paintings of Mason from his legislative days on Google Images. He was quite obese. And more important, he suffered from gout. The bronze statue of Mason at George Mason University in Virginia has him leaning on his desk, favoring his left foot due to the pain in his ankle from the disease. Gout is a chronic inflammatory disease of small joints due to the deposition of the liver waste product uric acid. See Fat Chance. Obesity and gout are both comorbidities of metabolic syndrome, the cluster of diseases that signify metabolic dysfunction, such as type 2 diabetes and heart disease. What are the two causes of gout? Sugar and alcohol. In the 1770s, these were two of the three readily available substances of abuse, tobacco being the third. But Mason was a teetotaler, so his gout and obesity weren't due to alcohol. Mason knew that sugar was a primary cause of gout because his contemporary Benjamin Franklin, a fellow sufferer from gout and other symptoms related to metabolic syndrome, knew that his sugar and rum consumption were the cause. He even wrote a famous poem about it. Similarly, Mason suffered from poor health for the 12 years after marrying Sarah in 1780. He refused to travel out of state, and in 1789, he declined a request by the state legislature to be the first U.S. senator from Virginia, as he would have had to have traveled back and forth to Philadelphia. Obesity and gout, both markers of metabolic syndrome and both consequences of his sugar habit, rendered him functionally disabled, just as it does 25% of Americans today. Not a happy guy. Two statesmen who birthed a nation. Both Jefferson and Mason yearned to steer the country toward the pursuit of happiness as an establishing principle of the Union. Jefferson saw it as a primary goal, while Mason saw it as a secondary outcome that emanated from ownership. Yet, both abdicated in the end. The pursuit of property and pleasure trumped the pursuit of happiness in 1788. Dopamine trumped serotonin. And it still does. No wonder we're unhappy. Good night, sweet prince. Flights of angels sing thee to thy rest. Aristotle argued, the pursuit of happiness and the avoidance of pain is a first principle, for it is for the sake of this that we do all that we do. Yet, it looks like our avoidance of pain has taken precedence over our pursuit of happiness, and it's come home to roost in the guise of our national opiate crisis. Opiates mollify the perception of pain, but in the process, they mollify the perception of life. And in the extreme, they mollify life itself. There have been drug addicts for as long as there have been drugs. In the past, most victims tended to be young, misfit, and poor. Musicians of the 1960s like Janis Joplin and Jimi Hendrix were easy to dismiss as part of the prevailing counterculture. Lately, such well-established talents as Prince, Philip Seymour Hoffman, Amy Winehouse, and Heath Ledger are just a sampling of those who have recently succumbed. But this isn't happening only to entertainers. They just get the publicity. Deaths from drug abuse are increasing in just about every demographic. Old, young, white, black, Latino, and now the middle-aged as well. Just look at the unfortunate consequence of secondhand drug availability. Inadvertent opiate poisoning of toddlers, which has more than doubled in the past 16 years. If toddlers are dying of accidental overdose, it's not just because famous and disaffected youth are the abusers. Athletes have long been using steroids for their performance-enhancing effects, but some have graduated up to opiates, starting usage due to an injury and then continuing it for its mind-altering effects. The same is happening with weekend warriors who tear an ACL or a muscle and end up using for the rest of their lives. A full 80% of heroin users started by using prescription painkillers first, and 1 out of 15 people exposed to those painkillers will try heroin within the next 10 years. Listen, when Saturday Night Live does a parody called Heroin AM, you know this phenomenon is mainstream. Why? Where did this come from? And why so fast? We recognize and bemoan the celebrity victims only too well, but do you recognize your neighbor, your bus driver, your kid, your pilot? Who are the perpetrators of this national scourge, and what is driving it? Pain doctor or drug pusher? The opioid explosion amongst the white middle class has escalated over the past 15 years. And surprisingly, the fuse was lit by the least likely of all pushers, the medical profession itself. Time for another brief history lesson you won't learn in high school, or in medical school for that matter. For the first 3 decades after the Drug Enforcement Act of 1970, we physicians were counseled on how not to prescribe Schedule II drugs, those with addictive potential. People in genuine pain, for instance, cancer patients, had nowhere to turn for relief, even at the end of life. Fast forward to 2001, a drug odyssey. In response to patient satisfaction questionnaires on physician behaviors, as well as inpatient hospital feedback, it was clear that doctors were missing and/or not treating their patients' pain. The American Medical Association and the entire medical profession did a complete 180-degree about-face. Treatment of pain was only cursorily covered in medical school, and the only course of therapy was opiates. But all of a sudden, pain became a painfully common topic amongst physicians. Was this a natural evolution in physician attitude, or something more sinister? The timing of this pain revolution temporarily coincided with 2 external changes in the legal drug culture. First, prior to the year 2000, the strongest narcotics, such as fentanyl, morphine, heroin, were only available intravenously, which left many people out of the drug culture because train tracks were grounds for losing your job or a child protective services referral. However, in the late 1990s, several potent oral opiates became available, such as OxyContin, Lortab, and Vicodin. Their introduction changed the playing field in several ways. The American Pain Society published new guidelines that advocated for doctors to aggressively treat pain. The Joint Commission on Accreditation of Hospitals, which certifies health facilities, issued standards in 2001 that instructed hospitals to measure pain. It became the 5th vital sign after heart rate, respiration, temperature, and blood pressure. But most importantly, the companies that manufactured these narcotics, Purdue Pharma, Johnson & Johnson, and Endo Pharmaceuticals, began to aggressively market these opiates for muscle and joint pains, even long-term, on the premise that because they were long-lasting, like methadone, they were not addictive. They promoted prescription narcotics use through medical journals and continuing medical education courses, and even funded a report by the U.S. Government Accountability Office to give it the imprimatur of government complicity. State medical boards started to punish doctors for inadequately diagnosing and treating pain. And these same boards willingly accepted money from pharmaceutical companies to disseminate these new guidelines. Recently, unsavory narcotic marketing practices by Big Pharma have come under fire. One firm pled guilty to criminal charges that they had misled the FDA, doctors, and patients about the risks of narcotic addiction and abuse by marketing their drug as a safe alternative to standard narcotics. Second, a new oral medication was developed to combat opiate addiction, called Suboxone, which is buprenorphine plus naloxone. It was approved in 2002, giving physicians an added sense of security that any addicts could easily be managed by preventing drug withdrawal. The advertisements from the pharma companies said that this combo drug reversed addiction because of the naloxone, which is an endogenous opioid peptide receptor blocker. But in fact, Suboxone is addictive in naive people because of the buprenorphine. Suboxone, the medical anti-opiate, became a hit on the black market as a legal opiate. The Centers for Disease Control reports that deaths from opioid overdoses in the U.S. have quadrupled since 1999, with 28,000 deaths in 2014 alone, of which half were attributed to prescription pain relievers obtained legally, some of which were then sold as black market drugs. Pain clinics are now almost as common today as emergency doc-in-the-box franchises in some cities. One-third of all long-term users say they were originally prescribed their opiates due to an injury, but now they're addicted, and 6 out of 10 say their doctor never told them how to stop. All of this has occurred while 99% of our citizens' pocketbooks are growing to their highest level ever, even after controlling for inflation. Although certainly not after controlling for the incomes of the top 1%. If the backbone of the middle class finds itself squeezed economically, drug addicted, and dying young, it sure doesn't sound like America's particularly happy. The new iPhone just isn't cutting it. The whole country's going to pot. Perhaps the most obvious display of America's current unhappiness is the state-by-state switch from one anti-anxiety agent to another. 5 states and the District of Columbia have now legalized marijuana for recreational use, and another 28 states have approved it for medicinal use. In Washington, Oregon, and Colorado, the 3 states for which we currently have data, the drop in SSRI use has been inversely proportional to the increase in pot use. Short term, marijuana has long been used to reduce acute anxiety, and many with terminal diseases have turned to pot to make the ride more bearable. But the question that still plagues us is, what does long-term use do? Numerous studies document that frequent cannabis users have a high prevalence of anxiety disorders, and patients with anxiety disorders have high rates of cannabis use. But again, is this cause or effect? We really need to know if marijuana use increases the risk of developing long-lasting anxiety disorders. Yet, sadly, the data continue to confound. One lingering concern is whether long-term marijuana usage causes brain damage. While it would appear that THC stimulation of the CB1 receptor does not cause direct cell death, there is a burgeoning literature that marijuana use can alter brain networking and connectivity, especially in adolescence, manifesting as altered educational or social development into adulthood. Even though marijuana is not covered by insurance, and it's regulated and limited to purchases of 1/4 ounce at a time, costing about $150, and it's taxed to the hilt, in these states it's legal without a doctor's prescription. The fact that thousands of people have turned their back on SSRIs in favor of pot in order to deal with their anxiety says 2 things. First, they're unhappy, and some may even suffer from undiagnosed subclinical depression, and 2, they're willing to spend a lot of money in an attempt to get happy. Furthermore, with the repeal of Obamacare and people not being able to afford their medications, expect to see an uptick in usage. If there's good news here, it's that more widespread legalization means more competition, and prices will fall. But then more and more cannabis farmers will cry foul, trying to maintain control over this cash crop. Ain't called the Green Rush for nothing. When the U.S. government starts subsidizing marijuana, and mark my words, it's coming, you'll know we've hit rock bottom.